minding the upsets and turmoils of human concerns. Perhaps it was the peace that one always finds outdoors, far enough away from buildings and clatter. Maybe it was the result of gardening, that quiet sense of pleasure in touching growing things, the satisfaction of helping them thrive. Perhaps just the relief of finally having found work to do, rather than rattling around the castle feeling out of place, conspicuous as an inkblot on parchment. In spite of the fact that I took no part in the horsey conversation, I didn't feel out of place here at all. Old Alec acted as though I were merely part of the landscape, and while Jamie cast an occasional glance my way, he too gradually ignored me as their conversation segued into the sliding rhythms of Gaelic, sure sign of a Scot's emotional involvement in his subject matter. Since I gathered no sense from the talk, it was as soothing as listening to bees humming in the heather blossoms. Oddly contented and drowsy, I pushed away all thoughts of Colum's suspicions, my own predicament, and other disturbing ideas. "Sufficient unto the day," I thought, sleepily picking up the biblical quotation from some recess of memory. It may have been the chill from a passing cloud, or the changed tone of the men's conversation that woke me some time later. The talk had switched back to English, and the tone was serious, no longer the meandering chat of the horse-obsessed. "It's no but a week till the gathering, laddie," Alec was saying. "Have you made up your mind what you'll do then?" There was a long sigh from Jamie. "No, Alec, that I havena. Sometimes I think one way, sometimes the other. Granted that it's good here, working with the beasts and with you." There was a smile somewhere in the young man's voice which disappeared as he went on. "And Colum's promised me to, well, you'll not know about that, but kiss the iron and change my name to Mackenzie and forswear all I'm born to. Nay, I canna make up my mind to it." "Stubborn as you die, ye are," remarked Alec, though the words held a tone of grudging approval. "You've the look of him about you sometimes, for all you're tall and fair as your mother's folk."
"Knew him, did you?"
Jamie sounded interested. "Oh, a bit. And heard more. I've been here at Leoch since before your parents wed, you ken. And to hear Dougal and Colum speak of Black Brian, you'd think he was the deil himself, if not worse. And your ma, the Virgin Mary, swept away to the bad place by him."
Jamie laughed.
"And I'm like him, am I? You aren't all that, laddie. Aye, I see why it'd stick in your craw to be Colum's man weel enough. But there's considerations the other way, no? If it comes to fighting for the Stuarts, say, and Dougal has his way, come out on the right side in that fight, laddie, and you'll hear your land back and more besides, whatever Colum does."
Jamie replied with what I'd come to think of as a Scottish noise, that indeterminate sound made low in the throat that can be interpreted to mean almost anything. This particular noise seemed to indicate some doubt as to the likelihood of such a desirable outcome. "Aye," he said, "and if Dougal doesn't get his way, then what? Or if the fight goes against the House of Stuart?" Alec made a guttural sound of his own.
"Then you stay here, laddie. Be master of horse in my place. I'll not last so much longer, and there's no better hand I've seen wi' a horse."
Jamie's modest grunt indicated appreciation of the compliment. The older man went on, disregarding such interruptions.
"The Mackenzies are kin to you, too. It's not a matter of forswearing your blood. And there's other considerations, too."
His voice took on a teasing note.
"Like Mistress Lear, perhaps?"
He got another noise in response, this one indicating embarrassment and dismissal.
"Hey, now, lad, a young fella doesn't let himself be beaten for the sake of a lass he cares nothing for. And you know her father will no let her wed outside the clan." "She was very young, Alec, and I felt sorry for her," said Jamie defensively. "There's nothing more to it than that."
This time it was Alec who made the Scottish noise, a guttural snort, full of derisory disbelief.
"Tell that one to the barn door, laddie.
It's no more brains than to believe you. Well, even if it's Nolier, and you could do a deal worse smart me. It'd be a better prospect for marriage, did you hear, a bit of money and a future, as you would if you're next master. You could take your choice of the lasses, if one doesn't choose you first.
Alex snorted with the half-choked mirth of a man who seldom laughs.
Flies round a honeypot would be nothing to it, lad. Penniless and nameless as you are now, the lasses still sigh after you. I've seen them.
More snorting.
Even this Sassenach wench can no keep away from you, and her a new widow.
Wishing to prevent what promised to be a series of increasingly distasteful personal remarks, I decided it was time to be officially awake. Stretching and yawning, I sat up, ostentatiously rubbing my eyes to avoid looking at either of the speakers. I seem to have fallen asleep, I said, blinking prettily at them. Jamie, rather red around the ears, was taking an exaggerated interest in packing up the remains of the picnic. Old Alex stared down at me, apparently taking notice of me for the first time.
"Interested in horses, are you, lass?"
he demanded. I could hardly say no under the circumstances. Agreeing that horses were most interesting, I was treated to a detailed exegesis on the filly in the paddock, now standing drowsily at rest, tail twitching for the occasional fly.
"You're welcome to come and watch any time, lass," Alec concluded. "So long as you dinna get so close you distract the horses. They need to work, you ken."
This was plainly intended as a dismissal, but I stood my ground, remembering my original purpose in coming here. "Yes, I'll be careful next time," I promised. But before I go back to the castle, I wanted to check Jamie's shoulder and take the dressings off. Alec nodded slowly. But to my surprise, it was Jamie who refused my attentions, turning away to go back to the paddock.
"Oh, it'll wait a while, lass," he said, looking away. "There's much to be done yet today. Perhaps later, after supper, eh?"
This seemed very odd. He hadn't been in any hurry to return to work earlier. But I could hardly force him to submit to my ministrations if he didn't want to. Shrugging, I agreed to meet him after supper, and turned uphill to go back to the castle. As I made my way back up the hill, I considered the shape of the scar on Jamie's head. It wasn't a straight line, as might be made by an English broadsword. The wound was curved, as though made by a blade with a definite bend. A blade like a Lochaber axe. But so far as I knew, the murderous axes had been... no, were, I corrected myself, carried only by clansmen. It was only as I walked away that it occurred to me. For a young man on the run with unknown enemies, Jamie had been remarkably confiding to a stranger. Leaving the picnic basket in the kitchens, I returned to the late-beaten surgery, now dustless and pristine after a visitation by Mrs. Fitz's energetic assistants. Even the dozens of glass vials in the cupboard gleamed in the dim light from the window. The cupboard seemed a good place to start, with an inventory of the herbs and medicaments already on hand. I had spent a few moments the night before sleep overcame me, thumbing through the blue leather-bound book I had taken from the surgery. This proved to be the Physician's Guide and Handbook, a listing of recipes for the treatment of assorted symptoms and diseases, the ingredients for which were apparently displayed before me. The book was divided into several sections, centuries, vomitories, and electuaries, trochs and lodochs, assorted plasters and their virtues, decoctions and theriacs, and a quite extensive section ominously headed with the single word, purges. Reading through a few of the recipes, the reason for the late Davy Beaton's lack of success with his patients became apparent. "For headache," read one entry, "take ye one ball of horse dung, this to be carefully dried, pounded to powder, and the whole drunk, stirred into hot ale.
for convulsions in children, 5 leeches to be applied behind the ear. And a few pages later, decoctions made of the roots of celandine, turmeric, and juice of 200 Slaters cannot but be of great service in a case of jaundice. I closed the book, marvelling at the large number of the late doctor's patients who, according to his meticulous log, had not only survived the treatment meted out to them, but actually recovered from their original ailments. There was a large brown glass jar in the front, containing several suspicious-looking balls, and in view of Beaton's recipes, I had a good idea of what it might be. Turning it around, I triumphantly read the hand-lettered label, Dung of Horses. Reflecting that such a substance likely didn't improve much with keeping, I gingerly set the jar aside without opening it. Subsequent investigation proved Perley's Ovis to be a Latinate version of a similar substance, this time from sheep. Mousier also proved to be animal in nature, rather than herbal. I pushed aside the vial of tiny, pinkish-dried ears with a small shudder. I had been wondering about the Slaters, spelled variously as Slatters, Sclaters, and Slateers, which seemed to be an important ingredient in a number of medicines. So I was pleased to see a clear, cork-stoppered vial with this name on the label. The vial was about half full of what appeared to be small grey pills. These were no more than 1/4 inch in diameter, and so perfectly round that I marvelled at Beaton's dispensing skill. I brought the vial up close to my face, wondering at its lightness. Then I saw the fine striations across each pill, and the microscopic legs folded into the central crease. I hastily set the vial down, wiping my hand on my apron, and made another entry in the mental list I'd been compiling. For Slaters, read woodlice. There were a number of more or less harmless substances in Beaton's jars, as well as several containing dried herbs or extractions that might actually be helpful. I found some of the orris root powder and aromatic vinegar that Mrs. Fitz had used to treat Jamie McTavish's injuries. Also angelica, wormwood, rosemary, and something labelled stinking arag. I opened this one cautiously, but it proved to be nothing more than the tender tips of fir branches, and a pleasant balsamic fragrance floated out of the unsealed bottle. I left the bottle open and set it on the table to perfume the air in the dark little room as I went on with my inventory. I discarded jars of dried snails, oil of earthworms, which appeared to be exactly that, Vinum millipediatum, millipedes, these crushed to pieces and soaked in wine, powder of Egyptian mummy, an indeterminate-looking dust, whose origin I thought more likely a silty stream bank than a pharaoh's tomb, pigeon's blood, ant eggs, a number of dried toads, painstakingly packed in moss, and human skull, powdered. Whose? I wondered. It took most of the afternoon to finish my inspections of the cupboard and multi-drawered cabinet. When I had finished, there was a great heap of discarded bottles, boxes and flasks set outside the door of the surgery for disposal, and a much smaller collection of possibly useful items stowed back into the cupboard. I had considered a large packet of cobwebs for some time, hesitating between the piles. Both Beaton's guide and my own dim memories of folk medicine held that spider's web was efficacious in dressing wounds, while my own inclination was to consider such usage unhygienic in the extreme. My experience with linen bandages by the roadside had shown me the desirability of having something with adhesive as well as absorbent properties for dressings. At last, I set the cobwebs back in the cupboard, resolving to see whether there might be a way of sterilizing them. Not boiling, I thought. Maybe steam would cleanse them without destroying the stickiness. I rubbed my hands against my apron, considering. I had inventoried almost everything now, except the wooden chest against the wall. I flung back the lid and recoiled at once from the stench that gusted out. The chest was the repository of the surgical side of Beaton's practice. Within were a number of sinister-looking saws, knives, chisels,
and other tools looking more suited to building construction than to use on delicate human tissues. The stench apparently derived from the fact that Davy Beaton had seen no particular benefit to cleaning his instruments between uses. I grimaced in distaste at the sight of the dark stains on some of the blades and slammed shut the lid. I dragged the chest toward the door, intending to tell Mrs. Fitz that the instruments, once safely boiled, should be distributed to the castle carpenter, if there were such a personage. A stir behind alerted me, in time to avoid crashing into the person who had just come in. I turned to see two young men, one supporting the other, who was hopping on one foot. The lame foot was bound up in an untidy bundle of rags, stained with fresh blood. I glanced around, then gestured at the chest, for lack of anything else. "Sit down," I said. Apparently the new physician of Castle Leoch was now in practice. Chapter 8. An Evening's Entertainment. I lay on my bed feeling altogether exhausted. Oddly enough, I had quite enjoyed the rummage through the memorabilia of the late Beaton, and treating those few patients with however meagre a resource had made me feel truly solid and useful once more. Feeling flesh and bone beneath my fingers, taking pulses, inspecting tongues and eyeballs, all the familiar routine, had done much to settle the feeling of hollow panic that had been with me since my fall through the rock. However strange my circumstances, and however out of place I might be, it was somehow very comforting to realise that these were truly other people, warm-fleshed and hairy, with hearts that could be felt beating, and lungs that breathed audibly. Bad-smelling, louse-ridden, and filthy, some of them, but that was nothing new to me. Certainly no worse than conditions in a field hospital, and the injuries were so far reassuringly minor. It was immensely satisfying to be able, once again, to relieve a pain, reset a joint, repair damage. To take responsibility for the welfare of others made me feel less victimized by the whims of whatever impossible fate had brought me here, and I was grateful to Colum for suggesting it. Colum Mackenzie. Now there was a strange man. A cultured man, courteous to a fault, and thoughtful as well, with a reserve that all but hid the steely core within. The steel was much more evident in his brother, Dougal. A warrior born, that one. And yet, to see them together, it was clear which was the stronger. Colum was a chieftain, twisted legs and all. Toulouse-Lautrec syndrome. I'd never seen a case before, but I had heard it described. Named for its most famous sufferer, who didn't yet exist, I reminded myself. It was a degenerative disease of bone and connective tissue. Victims often appeared normal, if sickly, until their early teens, when the long bones of the legs, under the stress of bearing a body upright, began to crumble and collapse upon themselves. The pasty skin with its premature wrinkling was another outward effect of the poor circulation that characterised the disease. Likewise, the dryness and pronounced callousing of fingers and toes that I'd already noticed. As the legs twisted and bowed, the spine was put under stress, and often twisted as well, causing immense discomfort to the victim. I mentally read back the textbook description to myself, idly smoothing out the tangles of my hair with my fingers. Low white cell count, increased susceptibility to infection, liable to early arthritis. Because of the poor circulation and the degeneration of connective tissue, victims were invariably sterile, and often impotent as well. I stopped suddenly, thinking of Hamish. "My son," Colum had said, proudly introducing the boy. I thought to myself, perhaps not impotent then. Or perhaps so, but rather fortunate for Letitia that so many of the Mackenzie males resembled each other to such a marked degree. I was disturbed in these interesting ruminations by a sudden knock on the door. One of the ubiquitous small boys stood without, bearing an invitation from Colum himself. There was to be singing in the hall, he said, and the Mackenzie would be honoured by my presence if I cared to come down. I was curious to see Colum again, in light of my recent speculations. So, with a quick glance in the looking-glass and a futile smoothing of my hair, I shut the door behind me and followed my escort through the cold and winding corridors. The hall looked quite different at night, quite festive, with pine torches crackling all along the walls, popping with an occasional blue flare of turpentine. The huge fireplace, with its multiple spits and cauldrons, had diminished its activity since the frenzy of supper. Now only the one large fire burned on the hearth, sustained by two huge, slow-burning logs, and the spits were folded back into the cavernous chimney. The tables and benches were still there, but pushed back slightly to allow for a clear space near the hearth. Apparently that was to be the centre of entertainment, for Colum's large carved chair was placed to one side. Colum himself was seated in it, a warm rug laid across his legs, and a small table with decanter and goblets within easy reach. Seeing me hesitating in the archway, he beckoned me to his side with a friendly gesture, waving me onto a nearby bench.
"I'm pleased you've come down, Mistress Clare," he said, pleasantly informal. "Gwyllyn will be glad of a new ear for his songs, though we're always willing to listen."
The Mackenzie chieftain looked rather tired, I thought. The wide shoulders slumped a bit, and the premature lines on his face were deeply cut. I murmured something inconsequential and looked around the hall. People were beginning to drift in, and sometimes out, standing in small groups to chat, gradually taking seats on the benches ranged against the wall. "I beg your pardon." I turned, having missed Colum's words in the growing noise, to find him offering me the decanter, a lovely bell-shaped thing of pale green crystal. The liquid within, seen through the glass, seemed green as the sea depths, but once poured out it proved to be a beautiful pale rose colour with the most delicious bouquet. The taste was fully up to the promise, and I closed my eyes in bliss, letting the wine fumes tickle the back of my palate before reluctantly allowing each sip of nectar to trickle down my throat.
"Good, isn't it?"
The deep voice held a note of amusement, and I opened my eyes to find Colum smiling at me in approval. I opened my mouth to reply, and found that the smooth delicacy of the taste was deceptive. The wine was strong enough to cause a mild paralysis of the vocal cords.
"Wonderful," I managed to get out.
Colum nodded.
"Aye, that it is. Rhenish, you know. You're not familiar with it."
I shook my head as he tipped the decanter over my goblet, filling the bowl with a pool of glowing rose. He held his own goblet by the stem, turning it before his face so that the firelight lit the contents with dashes of vermilion.
"You know good wine, though," Colum said, tilting the glass to enjoy the rich, fruity scent himself. "But that's natural, I suppose, with your family French. Or half-French, I should say,"
he corrected himself with a quick smile.
"What part of France do your folk come from?"
I hesitated a moment, then thought, "Stick to the truth so far as you can," and answered, "It's an old connection, and not a close one. But such relatives as I may have there come from the north, near Compiègne." I was mildly startled to realise that at this point my relatives were, in fact, near Compiègne.
"Stick to the truth, indeed." "Ah, never been there yourself, though."
I tilted the glass, shaking my head as I did so. I closed my eyes and breathed deeply, inhaling the wine's perfume. "No," I said, eyes still closed. "I haven't met any of my relatives there, either." I opened my eyes to find him watching me closely. "I told you that." He nodded, not at all perturbed.
"So you did."
His eyes were a beautiful soft grey, thickly lashed with black. "A very attractive man, Colum Mackenzie. At least down to the waist."
My gaze flickered past him to the group nearest the fire, where I could see his wife, Letitia, part of a group of several ladies, all engaged in animated conversation with Dougal Mackenzie. Also a most attractive man. And a whole one. I pulled my attention back to Colum and found him gazing abstractedly at one of the wall hangings. And, as I also told you before, I said abruptly, bringing him out of his momentary inattention, I'd like to be on my way to France as soon as possible.
So you did,
he said again, pleasantly, and picked up the decanter with a questioning lift of the brow. I held my goblet steady, gesturing at the halfway point to indicate that I wanted only a little, but he filled the delicate hollow nearly to the rim once more.
Well, as I told you, Mistress Beecham, he said, eyes fixed on the rising wine, I think you must be content to bide here a bit until suitable arrangements can be made for your transport. No need for haste, after all. It's only the spring of the year, and months before the autumn storms make the channel crossing chancy.
He raised eyes and decanter together, and fixed me with a shrewd look.
But if you'd care to give me the names of your kin in France, I might manage to send word ahead, so they'll be fettled against your coming, eh?
Bluff called. I had little choice but to mutter something of the, yes, well, perhaps later, variety, and excuse myself hastily on the pretext of visiting the necessary facilities before the singing should start. Game and set to Colum, but not yet match. My pretext hadn't been entirely fictitious, and it took me some time wandering about the darkened halls of the castle to find the place I was seeking. Groping my way back, wineglass still in hand, I found the lighted archway to the hall, but realised on entering that I had reached the lower entrance and was now at the opposite end of the hall from Colum. Under the circumstances, this suited me quite well, and I strolled unobtrusively into the long room, taking pains to merge with small groups of people as I worked my way along the wall toward one of the benches. Casting a look at the upper end of the hall, I saw a slender man who must be Gwilyn the Bard, judging from the small harp he carried. At Colum's gesture, a servant hastened up to bring the bard a stool, on which he seated himself, and proceeded to tune the harp, plucking lightly at the strings, ear close to the instrument. Colum poured another glass of wine from his own decanter, and with another wave dispatched it via the servant in the bard's direction.
Oh, he called for his pipe, and he called for his bowl, and he called for his fiddler's three.
I sang irreverently under my breath, eliciting an odd look from the girl Lior. She was seated under a tapestry, showing a hunter with six elongated and cross-eyed dogs in erratic pursuit of a single hare.
"Bit of overkill, don't you think?"
I said breezily, waving a hand at it and plumping myself down beside her on the bench.
"Oh, aye,"
she answered cautiously, edging away slightly. I tried to engage her in friendly conversation, but she answered mostly in monosyllables, blushing and starting when I spoke to her. And I soon gave it up, my attention drawn by the scene at the end of the room. Harp tuned to his satisfaction, Gwilyn had brought out from his coat three wooden flutes of varying sizes, which he laid on a small table, ready to hand. Suddenly, I noticed that Lior was not sharing my interest in the bard and his instruments. She had stiffened slightly, and was peering over my shoulder toward the lower archway, simultaneously leaning back into the shadows under the tapestry to avoid detection. Following the direction of her gaze, I spotted the tall, red-haired figure of Jamie MacTavish just entering the hall.
"Ah, the gallant hero. Fancy him, do you?"
I asked the girl at my side. She shook her head frantically, but the brilliant blush staining her cheeks was answer enough.
"Well, we'll see what we can do, shall we?"
I said, feeling expansive and magnanimous.
I stood up and waved cheerily to attract his attention. Catching my signal, the young man made his way through the crowd, smiling. I didn't know what might have passed between them in the courtyard, but I thought his manner in greeting the girl was warm, if still formal.
His bow to me was slightly more relaxed. After the forced intimacy of our relations to date, he could hardly treat me as a stranger. A few tentative notes from the upper end of the hall signalled an imminent beginning to the entertainment, and we hastily took our places, Jamie seating himself between Lear and myself. Gwyllen was an insignificant-looking man, light-boned and mousy-haired, but you didn't see him once he began to sing. He only served as a focus, a place for the eyes to rest while the ears enjoyed themselves. He began with a simple song, something in Gaelic, with a strong rhyming chime to the lines, accompanied by the merest touch of his harp strings, so that each plucked string seemed, by its vibration, to carry the echo of the words from one line to the next. The voice was also deceptively simple. You thought at first there was nothing much to it, pleasant, but without much strength. And then you found that the sound went straight through you, and each syllable was crystal clear, whether you understood it or not, echoing poignantly inside your head. The song was received with a warm surge of applause, and the singer launched at once into another, this time in Welsh, I thought. It sounded like a very tuneful sort of gargling to me, but those around me seemed to follow it well enough. Doubtless they had heard it before. During a brief pause for retuning, I asked Jamie in a low voice, "Has Gwyllen been at the castle long?" Then, remembering, I said, "Oh, but you wouldn't know, would you? I'd forgotten you were so new here yourself." "I've been here before," he answered, turning his attention to me. "Spent a year at Leoch when I was 16 or so, and Gwyllen was here then. Colum's fond of his music, you see. He pays Gwyllen well to stay. Has to. The Welshman would be welcome at any laird's hearth where he chose to roost."
"I remember when you were here before."
It was Lear, still blushing pinkly, but determined to join the conversation. Jamie turned his head to include her, smiling slightly. "Do you, then? It can't have been more than 7 or 8 yourself. I'd not think I was much to see then, so as to be remembered."
Turning politely to me, he said,
"Do you have the Welsh, then?"
"Well, I do remember, though," Lear said, pursuing it. "You were do you not remember me from then?"
Her hands fiddled nervously with the folds of her skirt. She bit her nails, I saw.
Jamie's attention seemed distracted by a group of people across the room, arguing in Gaelic about something.
"Ah," he said vaguely, "no, I dinna think so." "Still," he said with a smile, pulling his attention suddenly back to her, "I wouldna be likely to. A young birk of 16's too taken up wi' his own grand self to pay much heed to what he thinks are naught but a rabble of snot-nosed bairns."
I gathered he had meant this remark to be deprecatory to himself, rather than his listener, but the effect was not what he might have hoped. I thought perhaps a brief pause to let Lior recover her self-possession was in order, and broke in hastily with, "No, I don't know any Welsh at all. Do you have any idea what it is he was saying?"
"Oh, aye."
And Jamie launched into what appeared to be a verbatim recitation of the song, translated into English. It was an old ballad, apparently, about a young man who loved a young woman. What else? But feeling unworthy of her because he was poor, went off to make his fortune at sea. The young man was shipwrecked, met sea serpents who menaced him, and mermaids who entranced him, had adventures, found treasure, and came home at last only to find his young woman wed to his best friend, who, if somewhat poorer, also apparently had better sense. "And which would you do?" I asked, teasing a bit. "Would you be the young man who wouldn't marry without money, or would you take the girl and let the money go hang?" This question seemed to interest Lear as well, who cocked her head to hear the answer, meanwhile pretending great attention to an air on the flute that Gwyllen had begun.
"Me?"
Jamie seemed entertained by the question.
"Well, as I've no money to start with, and precious little chance of ever getting any,
I suppose I'd count myself lucky to find a lass who'd wed me without.
He shook his head, grinning.
I've no stomach for sea serpents.
He opened his mouth to say something further, but was silenced by Lear, who laid a hand timidly on his arm, then, blushing, snatched it back as though he were red hot.
"Shh," she said. "I mean, he's going to tell stories. Do you not want to hear?"
"Oh, aye."
Jamie sat forward a bit in anticipation, then, realizing that he blocked my view, insisted that I sit on the other side of him, displacing Lear down the bench. I could see the girl wasn't best pleased at this arrangement, and I tried to protest that I was all right as I was, but he was firm about it.
"No, you'll see and hear better there, and then if he speaks in the Gaelic, I can whisper in your ear what he says."
Each part of the bard's performance had been greeted with warm applause, though people chatted quietly while he played, making a deep hum below the high, sweet strains of the harp. But now a sort of expectant hush descended on the hall. Gwilyn's speaking voice was as clear as his singing, each word pitched to reach the end of the high, draughty hall without strain.
"It was a time, 200 years ago."
He spoke in English, and I felt a sudden sense of déjà vu. It was exactly the way our guide on Loch Ness had spoken, telling legends of the great glen. It wasn't a story of ghosts or heroes, though, but a tale of the wee folk, he told.
"There was a clan of the wee folk as lived near Dundragon," he began, "and the hill there is named for the dragon that dwelt there, that Finn slew and buried where he fell, so the Dun is named as it is. And after the passing of Finn and the Fane, the wee folk that came to dwell in the Dun came to want mothers of men to be wet nurses to their own fairy bairns. For a man has something that a fairy has not, and the wee folk thought it might pass through the mother's milk to their own small ones. Now, Ewan MacDonald of Dundragon was out in the dark, tending his beasts on the night when his wife bore her firstborn son. A gust of the night wind passed by him, and in the breath of the wind he heard his wife sighing. She sighed as she sighed before the child was born, and hearing her there, Ewan MacDonald turned and flung his knife into the wind in the name of the Trinity, and his wife dropped safe to the ground beside him."
The story was received with a sort of collective, "Ah," at the conclusion, and was quickly followed by tales of the cleverness and ingenuity of the wee folk, and others about their interactions with the world of men. Some were in Gaelic, and some in English, used apparently according to which language best fitted the rhythm of the words, for all of them had a beauty to the speaking, beyond the content of the tale itself. True to his promise, Jamie translated the Gaelic for me in an undertone, so quickly and easily that I thought he must have heard these stories many times before. There was one I noticed particularly, about the man out late at night upon a fairy hill, who heard the sound of a woman singing, sad and plaintive, from the very rocks of the hill. He listened more closely, and heard the words, "I am the wife of the Laird of Balneen. The folk have stolen me over again." So the listener hurried to the house of Balneen, and found there the owner gone and his wife and baby son missing. The man hastily sought out a priest, and brought him back to the fairy knoll. The priest blessed the rocks of the Dun, and sprinkled them with holy water. Suddenly the night grew darker, and there was a loud noise as of thunder. Then the moon came out from behind a cloud, and shone upon the woman, the wife of Balneen, who lay exhausted on the grass with her child in her arms. The woman was tired, as though she had travelled far, but she couldn't tell where she had been, nor how she had come there. Others in the hall had stories to tell, and Gwilyn rested on his stool to sip wine as one gave place to another by the fireside, telling stories that held the hall rapt. Some of these I hardly heard.
I was rapt myself, but by my own thoughts, which were tumbling about, forming patterns under the influence of wine, music, and fairy legends. It was a time 200 years ago.
"It's always 200 years in Highland stories," said the Reverend Wakefield's voice in memory. "The same thing as once upon a time, you know."
And women, trapped in the rocks of Fairy Duns, travelling far and arriving exhausted, who knew not where they had been, nor how they had come there. I could feel the hair rising on my forearms, as though with cold, and rubbed them uneasily.
200 years. From 1945 to 1743.
Yes, near enough. And women who travelled through the rocks.
Was it always women? I wondered suddenly.
Something else occurred to me. The women came back. Holy water, spell or knife, they came back. So perhaps, just perhaps, it was possible. I must get back to the standing stones on Craignadun. I felt a rising excitement that made me feel a trifle sick, and I reached for the wine goblet to calm myself.
Be careful.
My groping fingers fumbled the edge of the nearly full crystal goblet, which I had carelessly set on the bench beside me. Jamie's long arm shot across my lap, narrowly saving the goblet from disaster. He lifted the glass, holding the stem delicately between two large fingers, and passed it gently back and forth under his nose. He handed it back to me, eyebrows lifted.
Rhenish, I explained helpfully.
Aye. "Anoo," he said, still looking quizzical. "Columns, is it?"
"Why, yes. Would you like to try some? It's very good."
I held out the glass a trifle unsteadily. After a moment's hesitation, he accepted the glass and tried a small sip.
"Aye, it's good," he said,
handing the goblet back.
"It's also double strength. Column takes it at night because his legs pain him."
"How much of it have you had?"
he asked, eyeing me narrowly.
"Two? No, three glasses,"
I said with some dignity.
"Are you implying that I'm intoxicated?"
"No,"
he said, brows still raised.
"I'm impressed that you're not. Most folk that drink wee column are under the table after the second glass."
He reached out and took the goblet from me again.
"Still," he added firmly, "I think you'd best drink no more of it or you won't get back up the stairs."
He tilted the glass and deliberately drained it himself, then handed the empty goblet to Leora without looking at her.
"Take that back, will you, lass?" he said casually. "It's grown late. I believe I'll see Mistress Beecham to her chamber."
And putting a hand under my elbow, he steered me toward the archway, leaving the girl staring after us with an expression that made me relieved that looks, in fact, cannot kill. Jamie followed me up to my chamber, and somewhat to my surprise, came in after me. The surprise vanished when he shut the door and immediately shed his shirt. I had forgotten the dressing, which I had been meaning to remove for the last 2 days.
"I'll be glad to get this off," he said,
rubbing at the rayon and linen harness arrangement under his arm.
"It's been chafing me for days."
"I'm surprised you didn't take it off yourself, then," I said, reaching up to untie the knots.
"I was afraid to, after the scolding you gave me when you put the first one on,"
he said, grinning impudently down at me.
"Thought I'd get my bum smacked if I touched it."
"You'll get it smacked now if you don't sit down and keep still," I answered, mock stern.
I put both hands on his good shoulder and, a little unsteadily, pulled him down onto the bedroom stool. I slipped the harness off and carefully probed the shoulder joint. It was still slightly swollen with some bruising, but thankfully I could find no evidence of torn muscles.
"If you were so anxious to get rid of it, why didn't you let me take it off for you yesterday afternoon?"
His behaviour at the paddock had puzzled me then, and did so still more, now that I could see the patches of reddened skin where the rough edges of the linen bandages had rubbed him nearly raw. I lifted the dressing cautiously, but all was well beneath.
He glanced sidelong at me, and then looked down a bit sheepishly.
"Well, it's only that I didn't want to take my shirt off before Alec."
"Modest, are you?"
I asked dryly, making him raise his arm to test the extension of the joint. He winced slightly at the movement, but smiled at the remark.
"If I were, I should hardly be sitting half-naked in your chamber, should I?"
"No, it's the marks on my back."
Seeing my raised eyebrows, he went on to explain.
"Alec knows who I am. I mean, he's heard I was flogged, but he's not seen it. And to know something like that is no the same as seeing it with your own eyes."
He felt the sore shoulder tentatively, eyes turned away. He frowned at the floor.
Maybe you'll not know what I mean, but when you know a man suffered some harm, it's only one of the things you know about him. And it doesn't make much difference to how you see him. Alec knows I've been flogged, like he knows I've red hair. And it doesn't matter to how he treats me."
He looked up, then, searching for some sign of understanding from me.
"But when you see it yourself, it's like..."
He hesitated, looking for words. "It's a bit... personal, maybe, is what I mean. I think, if he were to see the scars, he couldn't see me any more without thinking of my back.
And I'd be able to see him thinking of it, and that would make me remember it, and..."
He broke off, shrugging.
"Well, that's a poor job of explaining, no? I dare say I'm too tender-minded about it in any case. After all, I canna see it for myself. Perhaps it's not as bad as I think."
I had seen wounded men making their way on crutches down the street, and the people passing them with averted eyes, and I thought... it wasn't at all a bad job of explanation. "You don't mind my seeing your back?"
"No, I don't."
He sounded mildly surprised and paused a moment to think about it.
"I suppose it's that you seem to have a knack for letting me know you're sorry for it without making me feel pitiful about it."
He sat patiently, not moving, as I circled behind him and inspected his back. I didn't know how bad he thought it was, but it was bad enough. Even by candlelight, and having seen it once before, I was appalled. Before, I had seen only the one shoulder. The scars covered his entire back from shoulders to waist. While many had faded to little more than thin white lines, the worst formed thick silver wedges cutting across the smooth muscles. I thought with some regret that it must have been quite a beautiful back at one time. His skin was fair and fresh, and the lines of bone and muscle were still solid and graceful, the shoulders flat and square set, and the backbone a smooth, straight groove cut deep between the rounded columns of muscle that rose on either side of it. Jamie was right, too. Looking at this wanton damage, I couldn't avoid a mental picture of the process that had caused it. I tried not to imagine the muscular arms raised, spread-eagled and tied, ropes cutting into wrists, the coppery head pressed hard against the post in agony. But the marks brought such images all too readily to mind. Had he screamed when it was done? I pushed the thought hastily away. I had heard the stories that trickled out of post-war Germany, of course, of atrocities much worse than this. But he was right. Hearing is not at all the same as seeing. Involuntarily, I reached out, as though I might heal him with a touch and erase the marks with my fingers. He sighed deeply, but didn't move as I traced the deep scars, one by one, as though to show him the extent of the damage he couldn't see. I rested my hands at last lightly on his shoulders in silence, groping for words. He placed his own hand over mine, and squeezed lightly in acknowledgement of the things I couldn't find to say.
"There's worse has happened to others, lass," he said quietly.
Then he let go, and the spell was broken.
"It feels as though it's healing well," he said,
trying to look sideways at the wound in his shoulder.
"It doesn't pain me much."
"That's good," I said, clearing my throat of some obstruction that seemed to have lodged there. "It is healing well. It's scabbed over nicely, and there's no drainage at all. Just keep it clean, and don't use the arm more than you must for another 2 or 3 days. I patted the undamaged shoulder, signifying dismissal. He put his shirt back on, without assistance, tucking the long tails down into the kilt. There was an awkward moment as he paused by the door, seeking something to say in farewell. Finally, he invited me to come to the stable next day and see a newborn foal. I promised that I would, and we said good night, both speaking together. We laughed and nodded absurdly to each other as I shut the door. I went at once to bed and fell asleep in a whiny haze to dream unsettling dreams that I would not recall come morning. Next day, after a long morning of treating new patients, rummaging the still room for useful herbs to replenish the medical supplies cupboard, and, with some ceremony, recording the details in Davy Beaton's black ledger, I left my narrow closet in search of air and exercise. There was no one about for the moment, and I took the opportunity to explore the upper floors of the castle, poking into empty chambers and winding staircases, mapping the castle in my mind. It was a most irregular floor plan, to say the least. Bits and pieces had been added here and there over the years, until it was difficult to say whether there ever had been a plan originally. In this hall, for example, there was an alcove built into the wall by the stairs, apparently serving no purpose but to fill in a blank space too small for a complete room. The alcove was partly shielded from view by a hanging curtain of striped linen. I would have passed by without stopping, had a sudden flash of white from within not attracted my attention. I stopped just short of the opening and peered inside to see what it was. It was the sleeve of Jamie's shirt, passing around a girl's back, drawing her close for a kiss. She sat on his lap, and her yellow hair caught the sunlight coming through a slit, reflecting light like the surface of a trout stream on a bright morning. I paused, uncertain what to do. I had no desire to spy on them, but was afraid the sound of my footsteps on the corridor stones would draw their attention. While I hesitated, Jamie broke from the embrace and looked up. His eyes met mine, and his face twitched from alarm to recognition. With a raised eyebrow and a faintly ironic shrug, he settled the girl more firmly on his knee and bent to his work. I shrugged back and tiptoed away. Not my business. I had little doubt, however, that both Colum and the girl's father would consider this consorting highly improper. The next beating might well be on his own account if they weren't more careful in choosing a meeting place. Finding him at supper that night with Alec, I sat down opposite them at the long table. Jamie greeted me pleasantly enough, but with a watchful expression in his eyes. Old Alec gave me his usual, mm-hmm. Women, as he had explained to me at the paddock, have no natural appreciation for horses, and are therefore difficult to talk to. "How's the horse-breaking coming along?" I asked, to interrupt the industrious chewing on the other side of the table. "Well enough," answered Jamie cautiously. I peered at him across a platter of boiled turnips. "Your mouth looks a bit swollen, Jamie. Get thumped by a horse, did you?" I asked wickedly. "Aye," he answered, narrowing his eyes. "Swung its head when I wasn't a-looking." He spoke placidly, but I felt a large foot come down on top of mine under the table. It rested lightly at the moment, but the threat was explicit. "Too bad. Those fillies can be dangerous," I said innocently. The foot pressed down hard as Alec said, "Filly, you're no working fillies now, are you, lad?" I used my other foot as a lever. That failing, I used it to kick his ankle sharply. Jamie jerked suddenly.
"What's wrong with you?"
Alec demanded.
"Bit my tongue," muttered Jamie, glaring at me over the hand he had clapped to his mouth. "Clumsy young dolt. No more than I'd expect, though, from an idiot as canna even keep clear of a horse when—"
Alec went on for several minutes, accusing his assistant at length of clumsiness, idleness, stupidity, and general ineptitude. Jamie, possibly the least clumsy person I had ever seen in my life, kept his head down and ate stolidly through the diatribe, though his cheeks flushed hotly. I kept my eyes demurely on my plate for the rest of the meal. Refusing a second helping of stew, Jamie left the table abruptly, putting an end to Alec's tirade. The old horse master and I munched silently for a few minutes. Wiping his plate with the last bite of bread, the old man pushed it into his mouth and leaned back, surveying me sardonically with his one blue eye.
"You shouldn't a devil the lad, you can," he said conversationally. "If her father or Colum comes to know about it, young Jimmy could get summat more than a blackened eye."
"Like a wife," I said, looking him squarely in the eye. He nodded slowly.
"Could be. And that's not the wife he should have."
"No?" I was a bit surprised at this, after overhearing Alec's remarks in the paddock.
"Nay, he needs a woman, not a girl. And Lear will be a girl when she's 50.
The grim old mouth twisted in something like a smile.
"You may think I've lived in a stable all my life, but I've had a wife as was a woman, and I ken the difference very well."
The blue eye flashed as he made to get up.
"So do you, lass."
I reached out a hand impulsively to stop him. "How did you know—" I began. Old Alec snorted derisively.
"I may hae but one eye, lass. It doesn't mean I'm blind."
He creaked off, snorting as he went. I found the stairs and went up to my room, contemplating what, if anything, the old horse master had meant by his final remark. Chapter 9. The Gathering. My life seemed to be assuming some shape, if not yet a formal routine. Rising at dawn with the rest of the castle inhabitants, I breakfasted in the great hall. Then, if Mrs. Fitz had no patience for me to see, I went to work in the huge castle gardens. Several other women worked there regularly, with an attending phalanx of lads in varying sizes, who came and went hauling rubbish, tools, and loads of manure. I generally worked through the day there, sometimes going to the kitchens to help prepare a newly picked crop for eating or preserving, unless some medical emergency called me back to the skulkery, as I called the late Beaton's closet of horrors. Once in a while I would take up Alec's invitation and visit the stables or paddock, enjoying the sight of the horses shedding their shaggy winter coats in clumps, growing strong and glossy with spring grass. Some evenings I would go to bed immediately after supper, exhausted by the day's work. Other times, when I could keep my eyes open, I would join the gathering in the great hall to listen to the evening's entertainment of stories, song, or the music of harp or pipes. I could listen to Gwyllyn the Welsh bard for hours, enthralled in spite of my total ignorance of what he was saying most times. As the castle inhabitants grew accustomed to my presence, and I to them, some of the women began to make shy overtures of friendship, and to include me in their conversations. They were plainly very curious about me, but I replied to all their tentative questions with variations of the story I had told Colum, and after a bit they accepted that as all they were likely to know. Having found out that I knew something of medicine and healing, though, they grew still more interested in me, and began to ask questions about the ailments of their children, husbands, and beasts, in most cases making little distinction between the latter two in level of importance. Besides the normal questions and gossip, there was considerable talk of the coming gathering that I had heard old Alec mention at the paddock. I concluded that this was an occasion of some importance, and grew more convinced by the extent of the preparations for it. A constant stream of foodstuffs poured into the great kitchens, and more than 20 skinned carcasses hung in the slaughter shed, behind a screen of fragrant smoke that kept the flies away. Hogsheads of ale were delivered by wagon, and carted down to the castle cellars. Bags of fine flour were brought up from the village mill for baking, and baskets of cherries and apricots were fetched daily from the orchards outside the castle wall. I was invited to go on one of these fruit-picking expeditions with several of the young women of the castle, and accepted with alacrity, eager to get out from under the forbidding shadow of the stone walls. It was beautiful in the orchard, and I greatly enjoyed wandering through the cool mist of the Scottish morning, fingering through the damp leaves of the fruit trees for the bright cherries and smooth, plump apricots, squeezing gently to judge the ripeness. We plucked only the best, dropping them into our baskets in juicy heaps